You're listening to the International Continent Society podcast. ICS is the leading international multidisciplinary organization for medical professionals working in the field of incontinence. ICS provides the latest scientific and clinical updates to professionals in the field.
Okay, everybody, welcome to another podcast with ICS. So today we're going to be talking about bowel dysfunction in neurological conditions. And we're really very fortunate to have a panel of experts with us today to try to understand the management of bowel dysfunction in these patients. So we're going to hear from these experts. We're going to go through some tips and tricks as to how to manage these patients. So just like to introduce you to our panel. And we've got Julie Story, Mr. Arnold Goode, and Professor Anton Emmanuel. So Julie Story. Julie is a senior clinical advisor for the company Renew Medical Limited. And her expertise actually focuses on rectal irrigation. But she has over 25 years of experience as a clinical nurse specialist in bowel dysfunction. And she's particularly interested in neurological conditions. Mr. Arnold Goode is a colorectal and pelvic floor surgeon and is the lead general surgeon at the National Spinal Injury Centre at Stoke Mandeville Hospital in the UK. And that's the world-renowned centre for the successful treatment of spinal cord injuries. He qualified in South Africa in 1996. And then he completed his higher surgical training in Oxford in the UK. And his current positions include the Director of Medical Education for the St. George's School of Medicine students at Stoke Mandeville. And then Professor Anton Emmanuel, he's an academic neurogastroenterologist at University College London. And he's a gastroenterologist at University College Hospital and the National Hospital for Neurourology and Neurosurgery, Queen's Square. He's a leader in the field of gut dysfunction and neurological conditions. His prolific research includes studies of gut neurophysiology, and he's editor of Frontline Gastroenterology. So those are our experts. Welcome, everybody. And we will get started.
So, Anton, I just wonder, just to set the scene, what kind of neurological conditions would cause bowel problems and what kind of symptoms do you see?
Yeah, thanks. And thanks for inviting me to join this expert group. So the most researched conditions are spinal cord injury, but the changing face of medicine means that the number of patients attending with new symptoms actually is less spinal cord injury than it was 20 years ago when I started doing this. So much more of my new patients in clinic nowadays are patients with MS, patients with Parkinson's disease, patients with cardiac whiner type problems. There are, of course, still spinal injuries occurring plenty, but they're mostly sort of iatrogenic injuries from sort of adventurous, more aggressive surgical and radiotherapy practice. So there is a sort of shifting demographic, but the fundamental issue is any disease which affects the central nervous system. So increasingly, we're going to our interest, we're moving into seeing patients with stroke, we're seeing patients with Duchenne, where there's some neuromuscular problem. Once you sort of lift the lid of this problem, most of us as gastroenterologists or colorectal surgeons tend to sort of see this as being, oh God, I see the occasional patient with this funny condition. But once you start exploring this, for those of you who are listening to this with an interest in finding that a niche, there is a huge burden of patients there who don't get well served by their being rude, their neurologists or their neuro rehab community, because their expertise isn't out there. And so you as an individual could to get expertise and develop that and be a really useful clinical conduit for these patients. So I'm making a plug there for the profession, but actually I think it's an important thing because there's a dearth of expertise and it shouldn't be the preserve of a small number of experts like you have on the call.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's what kind of spurred me on to want to do this podcast is that I increasingly also in my practice are seeing patients who just happen to have these conditions as well, and they think, oh, there must be more that I can do for them. And what symptoms in general do you see in these patients?
Sorry, I didn't listen to the second part of it. It's very bad. The ubiquitous thing I would say is constipation. I mean, so some form of difficulty with bowel function. Of course, constipation, as those of you ever heard me say this before, is a huge sort of umbrella of problems. It isn't a single entity. We may have our own personal definition of what it means when we've had the problem, but, you know, it encompasses bloating, straining, difficulty passing gas, infrequency, hard stools, needing to help yourself with a finger, needing to get somebody else to help you, any number of things or any combination of those things. So the plethora of symptoms that falls under the label constipation, and then the problems to do with bowel control. So, you know, soiling from your bowel or not being able to hold on, or not being continent of gas or not being able to differentiate gas from stools. And then there is the increasingly problematic, tricky ones. So those conditions, when I see those symptoms in patient lists, I think, okay, it's something I can do here, hopefully with the team. But the probably more problematic ones are situations where there is abdominal pain for which there is no structural cause, abdominal distension and bloating, which may fluctuate through the day, for which there is no organic cause. And in that situation, there probably is a neurogenic contribution to that. But there's probably also a functional, dysfunctional element to the problem, and that makes it much harder to shift. And that's the thing that often bothers patients most in specialist practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and absolutely. And Arnold, what about from a surgical point of view? What kind of neurological conditions do you tend to see in your line of work?
So it's thanks for inviting me to be here today. Well, because I'm at the spinal injuries unit, I mostly see spinal cord injury patients. But as Professor Manuela said, by default, I also get referred quite a lot of other patients with neurological conditions because of my expertise in spinal cord injury. So because you see quite a lot of patients with these functional disorders, you tend to get more of them, because there's a lack of provision of this service, or lack of understanding, probably. Mm-hmm. So I see mostly patients with spinal cord injury who have been managed really well, because I work in the spinal injuries unit. So they've all had access to specialist care in conservative management. Well, the vast majority have, and they've all been seeing specialist nurses, they've been seeing the spinal physicians who are rehabilitation specialists. So they get referred to me when it's deemed that this has failed. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes they want to come and speak to me early on about surgical options, purely from a lifestyle choice or point of view. They are very informed patients, spinal cord injury patients. Yeah. They have they've got fantastic networks. The internet has been has opened the world for them. So they network all the time, constantly. Mm-hmm. So they come very well armed with information. They know what they want, or they know what they might need, but they would like to come speak to someone. So I see patients who are quite well-versed, spinal cord injury patients. Most of them have exhausted their conservative measures for dealing with the symptoms they've got. Not all of them. So some of them there's quite a few who, you know, you can redirect. So you do need to understand all of the conservative measures before you start talking about surgical intervention. But I also see patients, you know, I see quite a weird, there's quite a lot of shared patients. Patients with MS who live out in Buckinghamshire, for instance, or in the regions around Bucks, because that's where we are located, who want to come speak to a local surgeon, because they think a colostomy, for instance, would be a better option, and that's usually when they've tried everything that Professor Emmanuel and his colleagues can throw at them.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of progressive disease, you see. So some of them will come to that, not all of them.
Yeah, and in general, in terms of the kind of bowel symptoms, does it tend to be the same things that Anton was talking about that you tend to see in terms of symptoms?
It is, and I think it always, you have to always ask the patient. So you always go back to the patient. It's all about the patient because this is symptoms and it's functional. So, as you know, there's no mechanical explanation other than the bowel is not functioning properly. Mm. So you have to ask the patient what their symptoms are. And I think it's also important, you know, that the symptoms Anton's just described are essentially what we see in severe IBS, for instance. You know, it is on the same spectrum of functional disorders, but it's on the extreme side. So everybody has, you know, we all have bowel function. It's when it becomes dysfunctional. So you have to really ask the patients, but it's the same symptoms. The symptoms of severe constipation, difficulty with evacuation, or uncontrolled evacuation, distension, abdominal pain. Although spinal patients don't always get pain, but they get similar symptoms, and they get problems like autonomic dysreflexia, etc. So a few little different special things for spinal injuries patients. And of course, the lower injuries can get, you know, uncontrolled incontinence, so the cauda equina patients. So it's in the same spectrum of symptoms, difficulty evacuation, requiring digitation or irrigation to be able to evacuate.
Yeah, okay, thank you. And there's lots that we've talked about already that we're going to come back to in a bit. But just in terms of just the background, Anton, I wonder if you could just give us a little overview of what actually causes these bowel problems, if we know.
I think we know from classic neurophysiology, but there's the vast majority of enteric neurophysiology we have zero idea about, and we speculate loftily and stroke our beards and assume we know things. So anything I say, I'll try and be clear about what's evidenced and what's speculative. It certainly is clear, as Arnold was saying, that there is plainly we all have bowel function, and that is subserved by a nervous system which connects our brain to our gut. And if you think about it, the gut as one sort of long tube, the bits that you have voluntary control about are the two extreme ends. You decide whether you swallow or not, and you decide whether you evacuate or not, and everything in between in that middle sort of 8 meters is completely outside your control. And that control is served by nerves from your brain going down your autonomic chains, but also by your spinal cord down to segment bits of the gut. But there's also this huge nervous system within your gut. And as I many times have said, you know, there are more nerves in your gut than there are in any part of your brain other than in your body other than your brain. And so, you know, you have this enormously innervated organ which controls itself under the sort of the traffic lights from your brain. And so according to, in theory, so spinal cord injury, we used to think was very clear that you'd have an injury at a certain level, it's either complete or incomplete, and then you switched off everything below that and you preserved everything above that, like in a sort of a, I used to imagine that when I was a student, you know, lights in a building and you could in a hotel and you'd close everything off. It's nothing like that. The reality is that the complexity of the enteric nervous system subserves various things that your body shortcuts. So, but broadly speaking, to give you an answer, higher lesions in the neuroaxis result in a situation where you get a dysreflexive bowel, that normal coordination of the anorectal unit between how the rectum expands to hold out content and the anus closes, but then voluntarily once or twice a day, the reverse happens. That reflex function is lost, and with that, sympathetic overdrive results in transit being slowed down, or broadly speaking, in lower motor neuron lesions. In theory, you lose the capacitance, so the tone of the vessel, i.e. the rectum and the lower gut, becomes flaccid, and your sphincters become denervated and also flaccid, and therefore you have this inverted commas retention-type paradigm. But it's not nearly as neat as it is for the bladder specialists, where they can discuss lesions in a much more robust way. So broadly speaking, there's that stuff around where in the neuraxis it is, whether it's above the cauda or below. But then there's also these increasing issues around things like Parkinson's, where you get both an autonomic mediated problem with Parkinson's, as well as the drug-induced problem, as well as a mobility and change in appetite problem, all of which contributes to bowel dysfunction, as well as dyspnea of the puborectalis. So I think if I was trying to summarize it with the gibberish I said for the last 3 or 4 minutes, there's a mixture of sort of central neuraxis stuff, which is above bonus, stuff which is below, plus contributions to the enteric nervous system, which actually try to mitigate that. But also there's neuromuscular things. And so any number of neuromuscular diseases or neural diseases can cause dysfunction. So it's a muddle. And I guess I can say one more thing. I'm sorry to give you very long answers.
No, not at all.
The thing about or train that complexity is that unlike many things in medicine where we try to say, oh, well, let's target the pathophysiology and make it better. Mm. Actually, the reality is what Arnold said earlier on, which is that, and Julie, I'm sure, will bring this out, it's about targeting the patient's symptoms, obsess about the symptoms and their impact on their life rather than the pathophysiology. And that goes against the grain for somebody who's basically a physiologist like me to say that. But actually, in this situation, patients are best served by focus on symptoms.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's a great summary. But as you say, it can be multifactorial. I mean, it can be as simple as, you know, not being able to get onto the toilet to use irrigation. And so that's why that's not a solution for them. So I think you summarized beautifully. But as you say, these patients, we need to look at each individual and work out what exactly the problem is. And Arnold, who is needed to look after these patients? I mean, you have touched on it previously, I think.
So I think, again, I want to say the patient. So you need the patient with you so that, you know, the patients need to, you know, you need to find out exactly what symptoms they've got, and they need to understand what their symptoms are and the interplay between what they do every day, what they eat, how they eat, physical activity, etc. Because that's really important part of their treatment is them engaging with it, because it becomes central. So bowel function is central to the quality of life of spinal cord injury patients. It's unbelievable how central it is when it stops working, like it is for all of us, really. So if your bowel stops working, then you can't do, you know, your life becomes, it just becomes your bowel. So the same for the spinal system. They need to be engaged. And a lot of spinal injury patients particularly will have carers. So they need to come with their carers, because they will explain quite a lot of the impact of care and facilities on how we can manage things. But then, of course, they need to, really important in me managing my patients is the specialist nurse, which is, invaluable. Mm-hmm. The practical application of things we suggest or changes in quality of changes in things patients can do to improve their quality of life and things like irrigation, etc. So a specialist nurse is absolutely central, and patients will tell them things they won't tell us. They will, you know, they'll understand the symptoms a bit better by simply discussing it in a more detailed or different manner. And I think that's really important, and getting that connection. So specialist nurses are really important. And the other physicians or medical staff who are involved with patients is quite important. A lot of patients will have family being their carers. That's very common, particularly as they get older, and all the chronic diseases. Very young spinal injuries are often single, but patients who are older and established relationships will come with partners who are as involved in their dysfunction as the patient is, almost, because it becomes a daily, hourly thing almost. So they all need to be involved and on board and understand the symptoms and understand how we think of managing it. So it's a big team. It's a big team thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And Anton, what are the problems that patients and their carers face when dealing with this bowel dysfunction?
So I think the biggest thing is what Arnold alluded to, which is the loss of independence, the change in their status, because bowel function is such a personal thing. I used to begin lectures when I was younger, ask people who in this room has had a headache, and ask people who's ever had backache, who's ever messed their pants. And no one, but you know, statistically, we know that 4% of us at some point in our life have had to change our underwear because we passed wind and had an accident or something, so I haven't made it, we had food poisoning. No one can stick their hands up. So if you imagine, that's a one-off. And of course, it's a silly example. I stopped doing that. but it's an interesting point about how sensitive, how personal, how intrusive this is. And if you have that cloud hanging over you, you know, you'll never leave that same bus journey. You'll never go to that restaurant again. You'll never have that meal. It's all sorts of ways. So the impact of these things. So there's a loss of independence. There's a loss of dignity. There's the uncertainty that comes with it. So beyond the things like us as doctors and nurses focusing on owls and what it looks like and how often it comes and who helps, there's also the thing about the uncertainty of what part of my life made that happen that day. Was it because I did too much exercise? Was it because I had eaten mushrooms 4 days ago? Was it because I saw my mum who always presses my buttons? What was it that made it? And so the patients find those second-guessing things, which, and often the role, I think, as Arnold was alluding to, is that thing that trying to get behind the symptoms, trying to, and that's where the team can play a part, or the length of relationship. I've had patients I've looked after for 25 years who told me after all that time something which they've been niggling away at for a long time, which turned out to be something actually which we could address, which is helpful in terms of their behavioral part. So I guess the beyond symptoms, beyond pathophysiology impact of their symptoms is where we really go. And if I can just pick up something that Arnold also said, which is, you know, that a lot of the time we do send patients for consideration of surgery at the end of a treatment pathway, but there are increasingly, as we get more familiar with this patient group and their needs, times when we actually move through the gears a bit quicker, saying, like, actually, in your situation, what's going to give you the greatest independence and autonomy and quality of life for the length of disease you have left with this progressive disease or whatever, is to move towards consideration of surgery early on. So this notion that, I'll mention this again, I'm sure, and I apologize for this to the community, that kind of notional pyramid that we generated 15 years ago is so incredibly out of date and so terribly something which needs to be torn up, thrown away and dismantled. Not that I have strong feelings about it, because it implies that a stoma is something which is remote and unnecessary, whereas actually for some people it's transformative. So that's a lot of answers to that, but I think it all of it underpinned by the fact that it's about thinking about the impact of the symptoms on the patient rather than thinking about just the symptom in isolation.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really, really helpful. Okay, Julie, we haven't even spoken to you yet. I apologize. What are the first line management strategies for bowel dysfunction? And that's a little bit naughty me using that term now that we're just talking about how we should get rid of that pyramid. But what do we start off with for these patients?
Thanks for inviting me as well. It's lovely to be part of this. I suppose it's, for me, I'm no expert on spinal cord neurogenesis, excellent stuff like that. So it's about when the patient comes into the clinic room with their partner, carer or whatever, it's about not thinking about where the level of their spinal cord injury or whatever is, but it's about what their actual bowel problem is, because that's what I was there to look after. And Anton and Arnold have both mentioned about symptom assessment. And this is crucial, but it's also with the patient thinking they've come into the room and they've never met you before and they're going to be talking about something really intimate and private. So it's trying to get a rapport with them, not giving them pity, but being very clinical and matter of fact and right, how are we going to work as a team to improve this? And so the first thing I used to do was just tell them what was going to happen in the appointment. It's going to last about an hour and this is how it's going to go. I'm going to check your medical history with you, explain all your test results to you, and then I'm going to ask you a really detailed symptom assessment. Because I think sometimes when we talk about symptoms, we kind of just clump constipation or incontinence as, are you incontinent? Are you constipated? But as Anton mentioned at the start, you really have to unpick all of that. So I'd literally asked a long list of questions that I would have in front of me on a list of paper, which obviously I knew inside out and back to front, having been asking those questions for over 20 years. But the patient saw that list of questions And it made it clinical, it made it structured for them, and it made them think they weren't the only ones that were, for example, putting a finger in their bottom to dig poo out or being incontinent. Mm-hmm. So the symptom assessment, I think, was the most, and I always bang on about it, the most important thing. And finding out from the patient, actually not what we as the healthcare professional think the problem is, but actually asking the patient, what for you is the main problem? Because what might be the problem for us isn't necessarily for them. And it's very easy to think, right, these are the symptoms, I know where I want to go with their treatment. But actually, some patients didn't want to use irrigation or whatever, even though they'd been referred for me for that. They were perfectly happy with their suppository manual evacuation. And for some patients, I was literally just saying to them, do you know what? Your bowel care is brilliant. You're using a suppository, you're continent, you're opening your bowels regularly. We don't need to change it. You're doing absolutely great. And to give them a pat on the back sometimes when they've got so much going on is crucial. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is, it's about not overloading them. These patients, the neurogenic patients that I used to see, I was a tiny little cog in their whole health journey. And they were seeing multiple healthcare professionals because they were seeing the urologist, the neurologist, the gastroenterologist, the bowel care nurse, their GP. Then they were having bloods taken. And they used to say to me, I'm just overwhelmed. I'm overloaded with treatments, therapies, and everyone telling me what I need to do. So it's about taking that into account, because if they've come, I mean, they used to come to UCLH on hospital transport in a wheelchair, so they wouldn't eat. And timing the appointment is crucial. So I never saw anyone before sort of 11, 12 o'clock with a neurogenic bowel. And I checked their address and work out where they had to travel from, because they'd sometimes travel for 3 hours, see me in 3 hours back. They're absolutely shattered. Mm. Chunk the treatment. Don't feel you've got to pack everything in to that first appointment. So I used to see them once, tell them what was going to happen, do that really detailed symptom assessment, and then start making a plan with them of where they wanted to go with this. But very much telling them, you do not have to decide today. So if, for example, the appointment was for irrigation, I'd show them the appropriate irrigation kit. I wouldn't give them too many choices, because, again, that's overwhelming. As the nurse, you kind of know which kit they're going to be able to use, having done your assessment and seeing them with their partner, carer or whatever. Show them the kit. And then I'd say to them, look, today you've got three choices. One, you're going to literally bite my hand off to get that kit ordered for you so you can start using it at home. Two, you need to go away, have a think about it within your bathroom and home setting and think, yeah, this is going to work. Okay, Julie can call me in a week and then I'll go for it. Or your other option is, do you know what? I'm just not ready for this. But I know it's there, and I know Julie or my nurse or whoever is there. And if in 6 months, a year's time, I feel I'd like to start using it, then I can contact you. So access to care, that brings up, that's absolutely crucial. And I had patients, Anton has mentioned, and I'm sure Arnold's the same, looked after patients for years. And I had patients that would email me 5 years after I first saw them to say, can I now start thinking about irrigation? And then I'd get them back to clinic. So chunk the treatment, start with that, and then build on it and be honest with them. Some of them think this is going to be some miracle cure, and it's not, and it's not going to cure everything going on. So it's about telling them that we're trying to improve your bowels. We're not going to make them better, but we want to improve them so we can thus improve your quality of life. And it's going through things like that with them. The other thing, I suppose, I was jotting a few notes as Arnold and Anton were writing about all the things I need to say, because there's so many things that we could mention. But their disease progresses as well, or they get older. So mm-hmm. that will change their bowel care as it would for everyone. And it's about telling them, it's as we get older, it's not just our hair, our skin, our joints, actually your bowel gets older as well, let alone the symptoms and the disease progressing and how that can affect your bowel. And don't worry, because we can look after you. We can change things to accommodate that. So it's making them feel safe and looked after and feeling listened to, and not going on your own trajectory of a journey with what you feel their bowel care should be, but listening to them and thinking, we'll do this as a team to help you. And I know some stuff that I can offer you. And if one thing doesn't work, I've got something else up my sleeve, always giving them hope. Follow-up is crucial. It's, I think a monkey could teach somebody to do irrigation, but that's the easy bit. It's actually making that if a patient's going to use irrigation, and not all neurogenic patients definitely use irrigation, there's so much conservative bowel care advice that you can offer. But it's that follow-up and tweaking it. So I didn't used to keep getting them back to clinic to see me because they came from all over and it was just a complete ball ache for them to come and see me. So I do all the follow-up care by telephone, mm-hmm. on the understanding that if they ever wanted to come back, then of course they could. But it was by telephone. And that's going back to that symptom assessment. That was brilliant because I'd have my initial assessment and all their answers in front of me. And then we could go back through the little details. So when they were thinking, I'm no better, Julie, because for them, maybe their main problem was pain, a functional type pain. But then you can say, ah, yeah, but actually you told me a month ago that you were opening your bowels, say, this many times a week. Do you know what? You've been once more that week. This is really good. You've had this problem for so many years. And in 1 month, we've just nudged it in a slightly better direction because you've really followed the advice. And we're making a little bit of progress, but it's going to be slow. Sorry, I'm totally rambling, aren't I?
I love listening to you rambling. It's great.
I don't know about Anthony and Arnold.
No, they look pretty happy. Thank you, Julie. Anton, do you have any further advice that you'd like to add?
So I think you've hopefully taken away the idea of sort of personalising care for sort of the audience. That's a kind of a central theme to this. And that in aspects is both from the sort of part of the evaluation, as Julie was saying, and how you time assessments, but also how you approach what you offer. I think the other thing to do is to not over invest in certain things that the patients sometimes get preoccupied by. So sometimes patients get preoccupied by a dietary thing that they think is critical, or they've heard from somebody else, I'm not saying ignore that. I'm saying that it's almost like just using your medical expert filter to say, is that plausible? Is that likely? I don't think I can explain that. But if you find that helps you, keep doing it, but don't get just boxed into a space. Because one of the things that we do sometimes see is some of these neurogenic patients end up, because they don't get help from anyone else, and they've tried accessing the usual sources and they've been usually rebuffed and given non-helpful advice, they sort of start having to navigate the space themselves. And that inevitably ends up in, it's like, if you ask me to fix a car, I'll do some Keith Robinson thing, which will keep me there until the next MOT, and then the man will look under the bonnet and say, what the hell's been going on here? It's because I've been sort of going along on a wing and a prayer. So sometimes I think it's about using expertise when we have that opportunity to disinvest certain misconceptions about drinking so much liquid, or because patients aren't going to therapize themselves out of being constipated from neurogenic bowel by drinking more water. All they'll do is put more strain on their bladder management and all the processes for that. Diet often is a red herring. You know, taking more fiber, which is making more bloated and gassy and windy, that actually accelerating transit any useful way. There's a sort of lot of minute detail, which I guess isn't, I mean, I'm happy to talk about any of the minutiae of particular aspects of treatment, but I'm guessing that this overview podcast is almost sort of give an approach to things. And then if there's a particular thing you want to run on, say, how do you manage incontinence? Then we can focus on that. The only other thing, sort of overview bit to say, is always think, and I guess this is slightly obvious, but remember hand function. One of the things that I think we often do very badly is when we come to this, and you and I do much better now than I used to, and I used to be absolutely terrible at it, was conceptualizing what people's function is like with their hands outside of the setting you're seeing them in. And, you know, sometimes their body habitus means that they can't physically, some of my spine bifida young adults just physically can't reach their body the way their body shape is. And the quality of control that you need to be able to put a suppository in or to separate your thighs to is that kind of multi-system thing that we take for granted when you're neurologically intact. It's conceptualizing that as part of your treatment, because patients often are too ashamed, weirdly, to talk about that kind of thing or don't think about it in the moment and then get home. Think, oh no, the doctor and nurse are far too busy to tell them about that. And then the kit or whatever else gets put aside and they carry on doing what they were doing before. And, you know, we often don't know. So I think think about this holistically. In those books that Julie was alluding to, they're helpful just always to give that kind of pro forma of things for us to think about, no matter how senior we are. It helps the patient, it also helps us to not forget some of the minutiae.
And I just wonder, you talked about diet, but what about medication in terms of improving the consistency or the function of the gut?
So having sort of naysayed fibre, the one time we really are very keen on fibre is if patients are soiling to liquid stool. In that situation where patients say, look, it's fine, my biggest problem is just that in my pad, I have to waste pads because I leak liquid. Then that's the one situation where augmenting fiber is absolutely clearly proven to be beneficial by creating a bulkier stool, making it less likely to sort of leak out post-voiding. That's enormously helpful. That's the one time diet is of value. Medication-wise, yeah, we use things on a tailored way. So, you know, patients say, look, my problem is primarily due to evacuation difficulty. Then giving them osmotic laxatives is the worst thing you can do, because all you do is just create a liquid stool, which they are soil. Whereas if patients are more troubled by the fact that, like, especially Parkinson's, where they just so infrequently get that natural urge, that spontaneous call to stool, then you need to do something to accelerate transit to overcome the effect of their Parkinsonian medication. Overcome the effects of their immobility, and we'll use stimulants or prokinetics with or without a stool softener, if that's part of what is also going on. So I think the whole thing about tailoring agents, rather than thinking, you know, my first line is fibrogel, my second line is what we call my third line, is it's not like that. It's back to that tailoring. So the conversations around that, and the pyrimide, again, you know, one of the depressing things in the UK, for those of you listening from here, is that we've lost access to liquid loperamide latterly, which is kind of tragic for me. It's one of my desert island drugs. It is one of the things I would say, if I had 8 drugs to list of things I couldn't do without for my prescription pad, it would be one of them. So we've lost that, sadly. Mm. But still, you can titrate loperamide dosage. And that's a really important thing. So patients who may be, in better commas, constipated, but to be able to get to work, to be able to go to their school play, to be able to do a shopping run, to be able to, whatever, to get onto a plane, to travel to, you know, whatever. Using a dose of loperamide to allow that is reasonable, providing they have the time with afterwards to deal with the bowel consequences of being constipated in an unnatural way. So I'm a very flexible prescriber in the neurogenic patient group. I think you have to be to reflect that thing about symptom variation, rather than saying, here's your laxative, take it religiously like an antibiotic, don't come back till you finish the course. It's much more about push and pull. And that's where Julie, and I used to, good fortune of working with her, was invaluable, because we were a unit, and we would be able to say things like, oh, can you tell Anton that I've been doing this and it hasn't worked? And Julie would know, well, what he would say is do this or whatever. So having that, making a big song outside, that kind of relationship where patients feel protected and isn't that, I saw the doctor and I'll see them again for my next follow-up in 6 months or 1 year, and I've got to stick with this for the time being. But they won't, because they'll take advice from other sources correctly and do better. So making ourselves available is kind of key element for this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a pressure, particularly in the UK, not to do too much follow-up with our patients. And so, you know, sometimes it can be really difficult, but I think for these patients and for lots of our bowel dysfunction patients, actually, they often need it. So We have to think about that as well. Arnold, in terms of surgery, what's the role of the surgeon for these patients? And you have touched on it previously, but what can you offer them?
So, for spinal cord injury patients, so this is what we haven't quite touched on before I go about the surgery, is remember that most spinal cord injury patients are not incontinent. Mm-hmm. Most of them struggle to evacuate. So most of them have a difficulty with evacuation and they're not incontinent until they are too loose by trying too many laxatives, which is kind of what sometimes happens. So the other thing is the consistency. So if the stools are too loose, if they have too much, if it's too loose, then they can't manually evacuate, right? So the patients will tell you that I can't use, you know, 6 movicles a day because then I can't evacuate my bowels at all because I can't get it out, you know, and then I need to irrigate. So that individualized adaptation is really quite important. But the surgery we do, so it's usually not for incontinence per se. Although if they are incontinent, then some of them are, then of course for spinal injury patients it's really quite important because they are at risk of pressure sores mm-hmm. and infection. And they can get really quite pressure sores quite quickly and get really ill quickly from that. So if incontinence is a problem, then it becomes more of an urgency. But the mainstay of surgery for these patients is a colostomy. Mm-hmm. So, and I must say, I think before laparoscopic surgery became a thing, it was open, which was quite a big insult for formation of colostomy. But now is always laparoscopic. So a laparoscopic formation of a colostomy, and I don't do a loop colostomy. I resect. So I think you need to do an end stoma. You need to resect that. It tends to be the sigmoid colon that becomes completely inert and it elongates. It gets very long. It's very flaccid. It just doesn't function. And if you leave it in, it still doesn't function. So we resect the sigmoid. We make an end descending colon colostomy, which is much less likely to prolapse, will have mm-hmm. better function. I'll put a little asterisk over there because they still have neurogenic bowel that hasn't stopped, which is what Anton said earlier on. And I also don't leave a long rectal stump. So mm-hmm. I divide it at the promontory. Don't go and do pelvic surgery because you don't want to get into complex stuff. But do not leave a long rectosigmoid stump. I have removed many as a second procedure because that long stump then builds up mucus and retains perforates sometimes, but certainly they get quite severe defunctioning proctitis or colitis, really, because they often have a bit of sigmoid left. Mm-hmm. A loop colostomy is just not a very nice colostomy. So loop colostomy stomas are... they're not nice stomas. They often prolapse. They often get hernias and they get overflow, particularly if the patient if they supine a lot, then it just flows over into the distalum. So they will still get contents going distally. So yeah. A resectional end colostomy, removing that inert sigmoid. And the surgery doesn't actually take that long because the bowel is so mobile. But there's quite complex anesthetic things, considerations with spinal patients. So the most common thing we do is for patients with neurogenic bowel dysfunction that are sent to me is will be a colostomy. There are some patients who only have hemorrhoidal anal prolapse type symptoms because of frequent bowel use or manual evacuation, etc. So they have a completely different coloproctology set up, particularly after many years of spinal injury. So there are some perianal issues we do with a little bit of mucosal prolapse causing incontinence. So you can do smaller things at the bottom end if only incontinence is a problem because of mm-hmm. prolapse. But the majority we find is patients with intractable constipation type symptoms, you know, distension, autonomic dysreflexia. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you. And because I was going to ask you about autonomic dysreflexia later, but seeing as you've mentioned it, Would you mind just talking through that with us now?
Yes. So autonomic dystrophy is really quite important. And I think if you go and I showed the spinal cord injury website, which has, when you look at the spinal injury center's website, under spinal cord injury, where they explain it, the first thing they mention is autonomic dysreflexia, and the second thing they mention is bowel symptoms or bowel care. And then they explain how the spinal cord works. Those are the two things that are most important. Now, autonomic dysreflexia is important because it's dangerous, and it's a medical emergency if it's not controlled. And essentially what it is a sympathetic hyperstimulation. So you get a noxious stimulus, which in our case would say be bowel or bladder distension, but it could be any kind of pain stimulus below the level of injury. And it's most common in patients with an injury above T6. So a noxious stimulus causes a sympathetic overstimulation, which is then not opposed by a parasympathetic, which down-regulation, which is what we would normally have. So you'll get pain. You'll be able to, if you're in a wheelchair and your skin get pinched, you would pull away because they don't have the sensation. So they get constant pain, sympathetic overstimulation, and the result is they get high blood pressure, bradycardia. They get this sympathetic overload, feeling of feeling extremely unwell, sweaty, a feeling of dread. They get terrible headaches, and they can get this from bowel distension, and they can get this from bladder distension. So patients, those are the two kind of key functional things in spinal injury patients that can cause autonomic dysreflexia. But they'll get it, after surgery. So if you operate on patients and they have lots of pain, except they don't have pain, they get autonomic dysreflexia. But you need to manage it. The risk is the hypertension can cause intracranial hemorrhages. But they can have it every day. Every day they do their bowel management, they can get a degree of autonomic dysreflexia, which is debilitating. The patients who suffer with it badly and who have quite a lot of bowel symptoms with autonomic dysreflexia, if they have to do bowel management for 1 to 2 hours, then in the morning, then they will be absolutely exhausted. Then they have to have another shower or a bath, or it depends how they have to have a rest, and then come 1-2 o'clock in the afternoon, they may be able to go out. But most of them are then, if they have it really badly, then that's their day ruined. So autonomic dysreflexia, even controlled, because those patients know how to manage it, can be quite debilitating. But it's an emergency as a concept. I think unmanaged, although most spinal injury patients are well versed, they are taught this from day one in hospital, repeatedly, and all their carers are about, not making it an emergency.
Yeah. Okay. That's really helpful. Thank you. Julie, in terms of a patient with spinal cord injuries and difficulty opening their bowels, when would you introduce rectal irrigation and how do you decide what type that you would use?
Okay. So usually when I was at UCLH, they will have potentially had some investigations, and it was often a consultant decision. So Anton would tend to say whether or not we could try more conservative stuff, and he'll have seen them in clinic as well and gone through medication, etc., or whether we needed probably to go straight to irrigation. But even those patients that, as I said, were straight for irrigation, sometimes I'd see them and they didn't want it, and it's about what the patient wants and can manage. Sorry, I've forgotten your question, Ali. It's not even early.
I know, it's too early. When would you introduce rectal irrigation and how do you decide which type that you'd like to use or try first?
Yeah, so it's to do with patient choice. Obviously, as long as there's no red flags going on where we can't irrigate them. And as Anton mentioned earlier, it's about what their hands can do, their physical ability, what their home situation is. I had one patient with a spinal cord injury whose bed was downstairs and had a commode in his living room. He was kind of living in a little one bedroom flat with a kitchenette. So he would have loved to have had transanal irrigation, and it would have been, I think, super helpful for him. But there was just no way that that was going to be possible within his home environment. So it's checking out all the exterior stuff with them, thinking about what they can actually manage. Are they going to need help with the irrigation? What their bathroom size is like? So it's all the external things that you need to assess with them and discuss. And then the irrigation kit, it would depend. So there's catheter systems where there's a catheter with a balloon where the catheter is inserted into their bottom, the balloon is inflated, and thus the catheter will stay in and they don't have to hold it, because a lot of neurogenic patients won't be able to hold, say, a cone in their bottom while they're irrigating. There are systems with a catheter where you pump the water, and I'm not mentioning different companies now, but you pump the water in. Or there's one with an electronic handheld device. And that, for some of my spinal cord injury patients, was brilliant, because it meant they could still be independent. It's about independence with your bowel care. I don't want anyone in the toilet with me when I'm going to the toilet. So it's about giving them as much independence as possible. But there's so many good kits on the market. There's now a kit which has a cone, which has, it's called a self-retaining cone. So it stays in their bottom. So they can use a cone system, which doesn't stay in, attached to a bag, which is gravity. So if your patient, for example, has abdominal pain, pumping the water in, I think, potentially can exacerbate that. Whereas if you can just turn a tap on the tubing and run the water in via gravity, that's a much gentler way of instilling the water. So there's other kits where they are mini systems, but they're not mini systems as in 100, 150 mils, because I've never used one of those on a neurogenic patient. But there's a MIDI kit where it's 250 mils with a cone. And that's such a simple device that they can just use on the toilet, some of them. And we've got one neurogenic teenager that's using that with a self-retaining cone that stays in her bottom. And her mum just pumps the water in from this cone before she goes swimming, because she was being incontinent in the swimming pool. Mm-hmm. So I think it's knowing your different kits, and there's plenty of advice out there from all the different companies that will help you with that. But also being savvy and thinking, actually, because now obviously I'm a company nurse, that companies want to promote their products, but it's about you always thinking it's not trying to keep the companies happy. It's about what's right for your patient, what they can use, what their toilet situation is. Will they need help? Some of them can't do this independently, whatever kit you try, and they haven't got anyone. You know, we can't always rely on their partner to help them. That's a very individual thing, and I never put pressure on there, because I think there's this feeling that, you know, you're married, you've been married 20 years, your wife, your husband, they won't mind helping you with this. Well, actually, some of them do mind very much. Or the person with the neurogenic bowel actually doesn't want their partner to be involved in their bowel care. But then involving district nurses, that becomes a whole new ball game, because they are so busy, they can't plan usually a time when they can come in. So we avoided that wherever possible. So it's about the patient being as independent as possible and thinking about your kit. So there's low and high volume kits, depending on what they need with their bowel and what the problem is, what their symptoms are, and what they can manage to use.
Yeah, that's really, really helpful. And I know that we've talked previously about barriers to using irrigation and things like that, which really need to be considered, don't they?
Yeah.
I'm mindful of time, and so Anton, I just wonder if there's anything further that you'd like to add.
No, from me, no. I'm grateful for the chance to spend time here, and there are sort of good review publications which go through the detail of what to do, symptom by symptom, sort of thing. I hope this has been useful to give us sort of an approach above all else, the need to not over investigate, over physiologize as patients, to to do the listening part, to sort of sequence the treatments, almost think through the, well, what are we after? Julie's question, what's the burden of mind? What's the symptom we're trying to improve? What's the functional outcome we want to achieve, more importantly? And then what steps do we have available to us there, rather than following a rigid pathway? That's the thing I think too. It's almost put the patient at the sort of, the patient's sort of goal as the sort of centerpiece of this, rather than to have a pathway from our perspective, which the NHS does very well, to put things in pathways. But each patient is their own particular sort of goal rather than a pathway to something. That makes sense.
Yeah. And it, where's the future management of these patients, and what do we need to do better?
Oh, so you want me to tell you about my research? Excellent. So, another hour. Excellent. So we are very excited. I mean, I think what we have is good if we can use it competently. I think the problem, if I can say before I say anything else about the future, is that we don't use what we do have well. So before we start looking for esoteric things and referring people to patients to sort of research sessions, I think about just putting all the stuff, that, you know, do the basics properly and then you'll win the World Cup sort of thing. But the future for me, since I, in 30 seconds, is epidural stimulation. We're quite keen on this idea. Got some intuitive stuff. And I think what I mean for that, by that in more broad ways, that I think different forms of neurostimulation are emerging. And we're nicking ideas from like pain, whatever else. So I think that's probably the next frontier, the way irrigation was the frontier 15 years ago.
Okay, interesting. Thank you. Arnold, anything extra that you would like to add?
Yeah, so if you want me to talk about surgery, that's going to take long as well. And I like research.
Oh, no, don't worry.
No. So I think the other thing is about it is what Julie's mentioned is the same goes for colostomy. I mean, I was just saying, oh, we do a colostomy. But actually, there is a lot of considerations with the colostomy, not least the carers, particularly in patients who don't have hand use. So hand use, or being independent with a colostomy, is a gift to a spinal patient. So they can, because bowel management, they often are not independent. Whereas with a colostomy, they are. And most patients will say, I wish I'd done this 10 years back, because suddenly they don't even have to get out of their wheelchair, providing they've got good hand function and providing you've put the stoma in the right place. Right. So it is really, there's a few little practical things, which again, I rely on my specialist nurses. They need to have their stoma site marked in their wheelchair and in their own wheelchair, not the hospital one, and in their own clothing. And if they have carers who will be doing it for them because they don't have good hand function, their carers need to be present so that it's marked in the right position, because it is so important. Otherwise, they still have to do the transfer. So that's quite important. You have to make sure that they will be able to manage, a colostomy, and have the facilities at home, etc., to do so, or the support. And the other thing is having surgery. So doing an operation on a spinal cord injury patient is inherently a risky business, right? Coming into hospital for these patients has a risk. It just coming to hospital is risky, right? So being in a bed is risky. So being in a hospital bed is even more risky. So you need to maintain mobility as much as you can, but you have to weigh up the risk and benefits quite carefully. And the patient needs to weigh this up. They know that they don't want to come to hospital. They're scared of hospitals, right? Quite rightly so, because they know from a lot of their friends, went to hospital, got a pressure sore, and, got some kind of infection or got a pneumonia, they are much more at risk. So you need to take stock of what benefit you're going to get. It's not just making a stoma. It's not, and the patient needs to weigh that up as well, because in the end, it is their decision. And then when you do it, doing everything to minimize the risk. So laparoscopy, mobilization as soon as you can, enhanced recovery in a different way, but it applies as much for them. They don't stay in the bed for 2 weeks like we used to do. And involving all your associate specialties, still using the laxatives, still keeping the bowel function. They all get ileus post-op. much more than non-spinal patients. So all these things are quite important to, and for every patient it's different. And so just, you know, for at every aspect, you need to kind of take that into consideration.
Yeah, thank you. Absolutely, all very important points and things that I've experienced myself also. Julie, anything else that you would like to add?
No, I just agree with Anton and Arnold totally. I think don't be scared of these patients. I think they present as really complex, but I used to find the neurogenic bowel care patients were my least complex patients. The very functional patients with no organic problems were my complex patients to manage. The neurogenic ones, I used to love looking after them and working as a team with them. So don't be scared of them. Don't be scared of the underlying neurogenic condition. You don't have to be an expert on that. I certainly am not. And I used to have to Google all the diagnoses that Anton used to send me patients with that I'd never heard of. It wasn't about that. It's about thinking you're there to unpick what is their bowel problem for them and how you can help them improve it with the consultant that is also looking after them. And I was incredibly fortunate to look after Anton, who inspired me in all of this indeed. So don't be scared of them, I'd say. Look after them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's a great thing to finish on, because I think that actually lots of the basic management, probably lots of us know already. And then we get kind of put off almost by the diagnosis. But actually, you're right, often it's the same management strategies. Well, thank you all so much for taking the time to do this podcast, and hopefully everyone will have enjoyed listening to it. I feel that we've just touched the tip of the iceberg in a way, and it has kind of, I've got lots of other questions as well, so hopefully it's just given everyone a taste and an overview. So thank you all so much.
International Continence Society podcast. Find out more about the leading organisation in multidisciplinary continence research and education at ics.org.